The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
So do you want to do one together since we have this unusual circumstance where I have two people on at the same time?
We'll have to write a script and plan it.
Yeah, we got a I got a storyboard of the thing.
Well, I
gotta
like,
find an investor and get insurance.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we're gonna be able to pull this off.
Okay, so it's live. So let's see. I guess we'll wait about 2 or 3 minutes to see if Tim calls in. If not, then I'll give him a call directly. Oh, there he is. Oh, he's right on time. Tim.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. What's happening?
Good. We got everybody on the line here.
Mark, hi, Tim.
Hi. How are things out there, Kentucky?
Oh, man, it's not too bad. Geared up for the Halloween season here.
All right, so let's get started.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema and music. Tonight, at long last, the long-awaited Indie Directors Roundtable on the Big Papa Online Network and on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Third Eye Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters. Cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, the long-awaited Indie Film Directors Roundtable with SOV auteurs Mark Poloni and Tim Ritter. Among the true leaders of the shot-on-video movement in cinema, both men started at the dawn of the video revolution back in the mid-80s, achieving actual natural distribution as teenagers for some of their very earliest films, more than a decade before the emergence of the internet, and through the old-school method of marketing your product to VHS distribution companies and signing deals with local and national video chains. From start to finish, nuts to bolts, we cover everything the aspiring director needs to be aware of, both positives and pitfalls, to get out there and express their innermost selves and create and distribute the films they've always dreamed of making without being caught unaware by some of the nasty surprises inherent to and involved in any creative endeavor. Mark is a veteran of over 30 movies in the SOV indie cinema genre since 1986 and still going strong. Together with his brother John, he's been a true force of nature in the field, with products ranging from the early groove of Splatterform to the more sophisticated co-production with Brett Piper of Muckman and many more since. With a warm humanist approach to a genre generally marked by its seedy and often extreme approach to groove, Mark brings a unique and heartfelt perspective and decades of experience to the table. Tim is a veteran of over 14 films in the SLV indie cinema genre since 1985, starting his career right out of high school at the ripe old age of 17, scripting, selling, and directing a film with national distribution and outside investor production cost approximately $250,000. Tim followed up on his early successes by delivering no less than 4 Mike Straubert Tooth or Dare films, relaying the viral nature of the cult serial killer celebrity, plus such fan favorites as Killing Spree, Creep, The Twisted Illusions, and Dirty Cop films, and the unusual but affecting slasher-slash-black-comedy-slash-exploration of spiritual belief, Reconciled with the Christ. A fellow 80s slasher aficionado, Tim brings his strong sense of humor and a realistic approach to his efforts, underpinned by a razor-sharp and incisive sense of social commentary. Join us for a very special Director's Roundtable with Mark Poloni and Tim Ritter, only here on 30 Cinema. In our first segment, Why Indie Film? And the first thing you need to know before diving in headfirst to the wonderful world of filmmaking. So without further ado, we present at long last the Indie Film Directors Roundtable.
Tonight we have with us not only two of my favorite directors in the shot-on-video genre, but two of my favorite people, period. Of all the people I've spoken to, these two men are certainly among my very favorites and have remained in steady contact from the first time we spoke about a year ago, before this show was even a concept. Among the true leaders of the shot-on-video movement in cinema, both men started out at the dawn of the video revolution back in the mid-80s, achieving actual national distribution as teenagers for some of their very earliest films. Please keep in mind this all took place more than a decade before the emergence of the internet, in the days when the only real option for getting your material out there was through getting your stuff picked up by VHS distribution companies and deals with local and national video chains. With his still ongoing saga of Mike Strauber and what are now four iterations of the Truth or Dare series, as well as such fun and quirky action horror flicks as Creep, Twisted Illusions, and the amazing didactic fable-slash-slasher film Reconciled with a Christ, a guy with a great sense of humor and a lot of talent, please welcome fellow 80s slasher film aficionado Tim Ritter. And to my right, we have a truly unique force in SOV, who with his brother John was responsible for more than 30 pictures since 1986, ranging from the early grew of Splatter Farm to the more sophisticated co-production with Brett Piper of Muckman, notable equally for his obvious love of classic monster bashes and warm humanist approach to a genre generally marked by its seedy and often extreme approach to grew. Please welcome Mark Polonia.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome, guys. So what we've gathered here for tonight is to present something of a director's roundtable. I mean, start to finish, straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, we want to run through what new and aspiring indie film directors would need to know from two experts of longstanding in the field. So like I was saying in the intro, you were both very young when you started, so a lot of this can be attributed to plain piss and vinegar. But the fact remains that you pulled together films that got national distribution in the days of VHS and which are still being re-released on DVD and discussed to this day. And more, unlike a lot of your peers who put out maybe one SOV or indie film before throwing in the towel, both of you managed to stick it out for decades, through some serious personal tragedies and setbacks in some cases, and have continued to create and distribute your own films throughout all these years. It's not even a case where you did something years ago, moved on, and now making a comeback, like what's happened with a lot of metal bands lately. You guys were going all along, despite shifts in trends, a changing market demographic, you and your friends growing up and moving through life, marriages, jobs, what have you. This is a lot right there. So the first question is about indie film in the first place. Why indie film?
Tim, do you want to go first?
Why indie film? I guess I'll go. I mean, obviously, growing up, and it's probably a very similar story you'll probably hear from Mark. It's just when you grow up under Super 8 influences, I mean, you find this passion, you see a particular movie that inspires you at a very young age, and what happens is you get this bug. And suddenly, when you overcome or figure out how to take care of, this feeling like I have to create, I have to make a movie, I need to get my parents' Super 8 movie camera. Oh, look, it creates images, and I'm making a movie, and you figure out how you do it all. And I think we're both from probably grew up in the 70s, and, movies like Jaws and Star Wars and, numerous other features were, it was a very original time for Hollywood, influenced us. And then we just kind of emulated what we saw, Halloween, Friday the 13th, those movies came into play and other movies. And for me, it was just, there was nothing else. I mean, there still is nothing else. And it's just kind of the only time I feel alive. And it's just kind of a part of life where you have to just do it because it's like breathing. It's just something that you have to do. So that was why independent movies, in a nutshell.
Mark?
That's a great, I echo Tim's sentiments exactly. And, to go a step farther, I could say the exact same thing. Movies influence you. You got a camera. It's in your blood. But, people always ask you, why don't you ever go mainstream? And, there's a couple reasons for that. One, Hollywood couldn't deal with guys like us. They really couldn't. And I'm not saying that to make it sound like we're better than Hollywood because, there's a place for everyone in the film industry, but it's our mentality, it's our drive, it's our desire. Can you imagine if they turned us loose on the set of Transformers 4? we'd be fired in 10 minutes because we'd grab a camera and want to move it, and a union guy would bust down on our head in 2 seconds. Plus, in the indie realm, you're allowed – or you have the freedom to express yourself the way you want to. I mean, I've been involved with other movies that were, much, much higher budget than I've ever made, and it was never fun, and the creativity was always staved by someone higher up who really did not have a clue about filmmaking the process or seeing something from concept to screen. And that could be frustrating. You needn't look any farther than guys like George Romero, Toby Hooper. I mean, I can't imagine it's much fun making a $20, $30, $40 million movie, especially when it tanks.
Right.
Right. And by committee as well.
Yeah. Because my take on this was, on the one hand, it's a great thing because it allows for a grassroots DIY approach with creative people, like you're saying, not being stymied by corporate boardrooms and intimidated by outlandish and outsized financial roadblocks or the need to incorporate high-priced, quote, name actors. You know, essentially it eliminates all the difficulties of moving along the established food chain and allows immediate gratification and expression of the individual creative vision. But on the other hand, I've spoken to at least one distributor of older independent films, mainly from the 60s and 70s, who felt this ease of access, in effect, you know, any kid with $2 and a camera could make their own movie, is killing the industry. It's like, who would want to pay to see or make an actual film with all the rights holders, established actors, union crews, etc., when there's extremely low-budget materials out there on the same shelves and more or less considered comparable? You know, his take was that the new indies are both putting the current industry, actors, and so on, as well as distributors of the older indies out of business. And similarly, I've spoken to at least one critic and author who feels, as I do, that much of what's out there these days, studio or no, is essentially crap and doesn't display the craft, art, and attention to the end product that the oldest films did. You know, the ease of access and quick distribution resulting in maybe too many unfinished, semi-developed raw product being put out there as finished and polished product. And as producers of SOV indie film from the 80s straight through to this day and ongoing, what's your take on all this? Where do you see the positives versus the negatives? And how do the positives outweigh any negatives in the end, or do they?
Well, you know,
wow.
That's a good
long
point.
Question.
I think, you know, again, it depends on which side of the fence you're on. If you're making, you know, $100 million movies like John Carter and, you know, they tank, people are being fired, you know, the
right.
next day. I can't imagine anyone at Walt Disney being fearful that I'm going to take over their revenue share because that's certainly not going to happen. I wished it were true. But, you know, technology and, you know, ease to access and all this new media that's out there, it certainly gives people opportunity. But those things do not make filmmakers. What makes filmmakers is someone with a passion, an idea, the dedication, the determination to sit down and make something. And when it doesn't work, they do it again, and they do it again, and they do it again. I mean, you needn't look any farther than YouTube to see that there's a zillion critics out there now and a zillion people making a lot of different things, and now they all have a soapbox. Whereas
right.
back when Tim and I started, it took a lot of work to get a movie distributed. It took a lot of work to get one made because of the technology. So there's good and bad. I mean, yeah, a lot of junk gets out there, and if a few people see one or two of it, they're going to dismiss everything. But at the same time, you know, it gives people an opportunity and a chance that they may not otherwise have had. Had Tim and I been born in the 50s, we would have had a harder time, I think, getting a movie marketed for the masses to see, because we would have had to shoot a movie on 35 or 16 at the least and blow it up. But,
right.
I mean, it is a good and bad thing. It's like anything. There's pros and cons depending on what side of the fence you're on, and there's pros and cons depending on how deep you immerse yourself into this crazy world of filmmaking.
Yeah.
Well, I would say pretty much the same thing, and that, you know, as far as the way the platform that your movie is seen, I mean, just for instance, I mean, the movies that I've made have all been they started out on, a lot of them in the early days, we shot on 16. They ended up on 8mm videotape, and we've gone through VHS and beta, Laserdisc, DVD, and now, like when Netflix started up, Truth or Dare and Killing Spree were on Netflix streaming service for the first 2 or 3 years when they put that service up, and we got hundreds of thousands of, you know, new viewers watching those movies, and the interest rose from, you know, people being exposed to it in a new format. So, although, you know, the people you've been talking to are correct in saying that it is an oversaturated market, it is more difficult than ever to, especially if you're just starting out, to get your work seen in all these different avenues. The DVD market is not what it was, but there's also the streaming market and, you know, other opportunities. And it just the fact of it is, and I was just discussing this with Michael Hoffman Jr., who did The Girl's Gone Dead. It's his new movie, and he was saying, yeah, it's a pretty good movie, too.
But he was saying that, you know, it just takes so long to find the market anymore. And what that means is, say, you know, his movie comes out, it takes years for people to actually, you know, it's not like an event film where everybody has to see, say, Deadly Dares when my latest movie comes out. Not everybody's going to see it in the first 2 weeks. It's going to take 2 or 3 years, if not 5 years, for people to discover this thing. And there's just so, if the movie's good enough, like Mark was saying, if it's put together well enough, if it's solid, if you got a vision in there, if you put cinematic effort into it, no matter what your budget, no matter what you shot it on, eventually the quality is going to show through, and people are going to find it. You just have to have a lot of tenacity about it, and you know it's a very big challenge to go against. It's kind of like David and Goliath, to go against this gigantic industry where there's so many opportunities, yet there's not so many opportunities to get your movie shown. It's just kind of like a slow burn. But for Deadly Dares, we've been playing the movie for the past year in independent cinema, digital cinema, like the re-release of Halloween, this coming Halloween, and so many different movies are being released like this. What was it? Jaws just had when they did the Blu-ray release, it just had a digital showing. So this is an opportunity for, you know, movies of independent spirit that, you know, are competently put together to, you know, to get into these chain theaters even. So every time you turn around, when one thing closes, another door, you know, opens, or you just got to be looking for these kind of opportunities to kind of get your movie out there. So there's never really, you know, a complete shutout, I would say. But it is very, very difficult and very, very time consuming, and it just, you know, you just can't stop. So,
and I'm sure I'm sure you both know, and of course listeners to the show know, that I'm very much on the side of independent shot on video and just people getting out there and do it themselves, as opposed to the Hollywood machine, which just doesn't work for me. And I don't know if it ever worked for me, but it certainly hasn't since the 70s. But that said, there was some merit to the argument, and I've heard it at least 2 times from a couple different people, one who was quite forceful about it. So I wanted to get it out there and see what you guys thought. Now, in terms of getting started, let's just say you're someone, I hesitate to say a kid because I want to emphasize that you can get involved in this at any age and don't want to perpetuate the old line about having to start young and everything, which I'm finding just isn't true. But you're someone just starting out. You want to make a film outside the established studio system. Is there anything you would recommend prospective filmmakers know, study, or read? You know, what's the first thing you need to have in hand before you start approaching people?
Well, you know, you obviously have to have a solid idea. You have to have a game plan. You know, you've got to prove to people that you're serious. They have to see that you're passionate about it, because I think on a set, you know, the director, the ringleader, a lot of people feed off their energy. So, you know, if you go in there with a, hey, we're going to do this, I want to do this, I want you to be a part of this, it's going to be great, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, I'm going to make a movie and I want you to be a part of it. You know, people read into that. It's not necessarily about, okay, how much are we going to get paid to be in this? It's about being a part of something that's fun, that you can call a piece of your own, and that could lead to something later on down the road. I think most of all, young filmmakers or new filmmakers, they need a vision, and they need to be serious about it, and they need to know that it is, like Tim said, it is not easy. I think that's why so many filmmakers that sprung up around the same time as us, where are they? You know, where did they go? What happened to them? What happened to the dream that they had?
Exactly.
You know, I can't answer that, but I think that is one of, there's a lot of important things, but I think if I was someone that was going to get involved in a production with a first-time filmmaker, that's what I would want to see.
So, Tim, what do you think?
I would agree with that, and I would say, going back, just thinking about how I started as a teenager, it was always, okay, I'm watching different movies, I'm influenced by different directors, you know, I'm absorbing the material, the genre, I love it, I become it. Suddenly, I've got an idea that's, you know, hey, this is kind of like Halloween, but I'm going to add my own little twist to it, and that's what I'm thinking, and I'm like, and then it's like, oh, okay, well, what can I add to the mix? So the thing that is, I would say to anybody starting out is you just have to have an idea and a story and a good script, all one thing. You know, your idea, you know, hammered out into just a really solid script. It doesn't have to be perfect, but something that you really believe in. And you believe in it so much that no matter what, no matter what mountain you have to you know, climb or move to make this happen, that you're going to see it. And That's the whole thing that captivates, you know, everything that Mark was talking about. When you, when you're so excited about it, and you're like, okay, then you kind of network, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's on, you know, different movie-making sites or whether it's in film school or with other people of like-minded interests, wherever you meet them, that you're just going to be bursting with this incredible, you know, enthusiasm. And, you know, your, people are going to gravitate to you, and money's not going to be an issue, and they're all going to start to join in on the cause and help you, and then that's when you make your battle plan, and, of course, extreme planning. But that, it all starts with a really solid script that you can break down, see how much money you're going to need or what cuts you're going to have to make or however you're going to, you know, approach this project, and just get started in doing. And I think every horror movie that's been successful, from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Last House on the Left, Halloween, all, I mean, they all start out like that. Just, you've probably heard Carpenter's story a million times, but the producer saying, hey, make us a movie about babysitter murders, and then somebody came up with the idea of, let's set it on Halloween, and they were on fire. I mean, you got to be on fire. That's what I would say. So.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing from both of you is the same thing that I feel, that you, the passion comes first, and then after that, everything kind of falls into place. So, you know, it's not necessarily a case of just going in head first and, you know, finding out the pool is empty. But, you know, you do have to have a little bit of something backing you up, some sort of knowledge, some sort of awareness. But the passion is much more important than going in there and having all these technical skills and then just becoming, you know, Mr. Corporate, because then what's the point? You're just going to make garbage.
Right. And, you know, the real test is when you're making your first movie, and all of a sudden there's a crisis. That's when the true test occurs. What do you do to get beyond that? How do you make it work? And you just keep moving, because as Tim would attest, on a low-budget show, momentum is the key. And, you know, problems are going to come up. Actors don't know their lines. They just don't show up. You have a technical malfunction. You get kicked out of a location. These are things that new filmmakers, if they're not flexible and thinking outside of the box, it'll ruin a production right there. And once that happens, then that's when things start to unravel. And, you know, I work with young people. I work at a college, and I this is funny because Tim mentioned a mountain, and I had a student sitting right in front of me, and he said, I don't know what to do about this. It's like there's a giant mountain in front of me. He was talking about this project he had to do. I said, just say to yourself, what's the view going to look like when I get to the top? That's
sure.
The attitude you have to have.
And I also agree about the flexibility, because I find that just in life, that, you know, the more able you are to bend, and, you know, you say I think outside the box, I'm not always good at doing that myself, but, you know, being able to roll with the punches, as it were. Okay, well, today we're rained out. Today this guy didn't show up. Well, let's film another scene. Let's try to come up with some other way to accomplish at least another part of what we need to get done. And that way we're still moving. We aren't in stasis until we get the perfect whatever, because the perfect time never comes. For, you know, if you just sit there waiting forever, your whole life's going to pass by.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guests tonight, Mark Maloney and Tim Ritter. More of the Indie Roundup. Director's Roundtable coming up after this.
Arch Hall Jr. Probably you remember me from EGA and the Choppers and maybe the Sadist, but especially EGA. Well, I just want you to know you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
That was great.
Hey there, guys and gals. This is David Heavener from Eye of the Stranger and Kill Crazy. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hello, this is Herschel Gordon Lewis. You may or may not know who I am, but I know who I am. I'm the guy who directed movies such as Blood Feast and 2000 Maniacs and The Wizard of Gore And right now I'm having a very good time, as I hope you are too, listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Wow. Those are both fantastic.
Okay, that'll be about $22,000 each.
I see nothing's changed on your rehearsal.
That's how I live, Dean.
Hello, everyone. This is Roberta Finlay, devout listener of Third Eye Cinema, also director and DP of such sterling cinema as Lurkers, Blood Sisters, The Oracle, and many more. At this point in time, I'm the manager and principal officer at Seer Sound, which is a Midtown recording studio to the stars, featuring analog and digital equipment. Thank you.
And in our next segment, we'll be talking equipment, film versus video, and the role of the producer.
Film or video, should those coming into the field rent equipment or purchase? Now, what are the pitfalls or advantages of either approach?
Well, I guess I'll start this one. It depends on the project. I mean, if you're a guy or a gal and you're out there and you're just planning to do stuff and you're just starting out and you're doing your own projects and you're planning to do a lot of projects, my advice would be buy, you know, whatever HD equipment or, you know, digital equipment that you can afford, and make sure that your computer and your editing and all match, because these days with codecs and all that kind of thing, you want to make sure that, you know, everything's going to do it if you're doing it on a small scale. Now, bigger movies, if you've got a bigger budget, you know, and you're planning to do, you know, a movie for a couple hundred thousand or whatever, obviously you just want to rent, because, you know, who wants to go buy a 4K digital camera? I mean, what are you going to do with it after that movie? I mean,
right.
It's going to break your budget right there. Although, a lot of them are coming down to like $4,000 to $6,000 and everything. But you really, unless you're really a production company that's planning to do, you know, X amount of movies, you want to get a DOP, which is a director of photography or videography. And usually they already own the equipment. You're going to hire that for a higher budget a movie. But it just depends on your circumstances and, you know, what you plan to do and, you know, how you're going about it. Are you just doing movies for YouTube to get noticed and, you know, to start out and, you know, that kind of thing? Or, like you said, if it's a finance movie, then you're definitely best off just, you know, hiring people that have that sort of equipment and networking with, you know, people who might be able to give you a good rate on that kind of thing. So depends on, you know, what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, Tim's right. I mean, you know, it depends on your situation. It's funny, by the time Tim and I get to a position where we could finally make a theatrical movie, they won't be using 35mm film anymore. I always wanted a photo of me behind a Panavision camera sitting on a crane about 8 feet off the ground pointing at somebody. That's never going to happen.
We'll put our faces over him.
There you go. Who would know except for the 70s cutoff jeans, right?
Right.
But Tim's right. You use what you can afford. Look at the end destination of your product. You know, digital and film, it's an emerging world now. I would assume in 10 years they won't even be shooting. They won't even call them films, because technically they won't even be that. It'll be something else. They'll come up with a copyrighted name that we'll have to pay to say and use. But, you know, it's technology. Technology moves ahead, and you have to adapt to it and find a way to tap the market you're looking for, but keep it affordable. And, you know, buying equipment is not always the answer. That's a good way to never get a film made, because you'll have all your money tied up in equipment. But,
right.
And it's outdated. Like 6 months later, it's like, hey, I got this super 3K HD camera, and you know what? The next thing's ever to come up. So.
Right, it's obsolete already.
So, right, you have a boat anchor.
So this is a sort of related question. What sort of equipment is worth investing in or making use of? Because I presume we're not talking commercial-grade video here. You know, I'm assuming we're sticking to literal SOV terms and not 16mm indie film that gets blown up to 35. You know, you have to be getting a more professional-grade camera, not to mention lighting, boom mics and sound, whatever software or processing editing facilities. What do you think?
I use Final Cut Pro to edit. I use Avid. We use Panasonic, Canon, P2, HD cameras. You know, we have dollies. We have a jib. We have, you know, airy light kits. We have soft lights. We have all kinds of things to technically make a movie, but, you know, I have to look no farther back than when we started. You know, we had a We had a VHS camera and a couple old movie lights, and that's what we did. And, you know, you use what you have. I mean, the last thing I hate to hear out of people's mouths is, yeah, I'm going to make my movie when I get all this stuff. Well, you know what? If you start making movies when you get all that stuff, you won't know what the hell to do with it all when it's surrounding you and you have to get something shot.
Right.
Use what you have. If all you have is your grandpa's camera, go out and make a movie with your grandpa's camera.
I agree.
You know, the equipment comes in time, but you can have tons of equipment but still not know how to make a technically competent movie. That's my take on it. I mean, there's so much out there. It's, you know, you definitely probably want to stay away from film unless you're after that look. But with digital video and HD, it's a more acceptable format than when we were doing it. When people saw video, you know, we were the redheaded stepchildren.
Right.
Tim, I hope you're not a redhead, but that's just an analogy.
Cut off all my hair.
Yeah,
I can't tell, man.
But now it's acceptable. You know, now it's an acceptable format. And people like George Lucas brag about it, and it's like, hey, George, we were there 20 years ago. Don't pat yourself on the back. Why don't you sit down and talk with us for about an hour?
And it's true, because it was like we were talking about when we spoke like a year ago. At the time that you guys had started out making shot on video, the stigma was there because the only other thing that was being shot on video at the time was porn. So, therefore, it was like you guys were lumped in with porn productions, and it was nothing like that, but that was the view of it. Whereas now, because film has basically...
They got paid
away,
better than us.
And man got a better view. But, you know, now that film is
basically... I almost got the porn look, but I think I fell short a little bit. Never did get that quality, I don't think, of the early three-quarter-inch porn movie.
Well, what do you think on this, Tim? What's your recommendation?
I agree. I think I've never had a problem with video. I mean, some of my favorite TV shows, even growing up, these companies and whatever, you know, it's all shot on video. I mean, I never had a problem with it, but you're saying, and I, like I mentioned before, now there's digital cinema. Even the studios are eventually going to be getting rid of 35mm and whatever millimeter movies. It's just going to cost them a lot less money to beam stuff digitally by satellite to theaters, and we had the same option with independent cinemas to utilize whatever we shoot in and just convert it to a digital format. Even if you're shooting in VHS analog, you just transfer it over to, you know, a digital format, and you'll be able to beam that into a theater. So if that's all you have, then definitely that's what you should be using. And I mean, I still use a digital 8 camera, and we shot Deadly Dares with a Canon HD VX40 or something, and that's definitely not what I would call a top-of-the-line camera, but it's very solid. And as far as broadcast quality, I mean, I've never really even understood exactly what that is. I mean, you look at, like, America's Home Videos, and they're running pixel vision clips on the television screen, and then on the other hand, they're saying, hey, you can have this because it isn't professional quality. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Here's another example, Blair Witch Project. That movie made, what, 150, 200 million? It was shot on high 8. So it really depends on what you have access to. Just get out there, film it. There are endless ways to attempt to platform and to get that movie seen, whether it's a spinning disc or a spinning beam satellite into a theater or streaming or whatever it is. I mean, Netflix used like an old VHS copy of Truth or Dare when they had it on their streaming service. So, I mean, it's like, wasn't exactly great quality, but the movie was up there. And like I said, like I mentioned, you know, thousands of new viewers watched it. So the question really boils down to, again, are you making something you want to see? And is there an audience like you that also wants to see, you know, what you're creating, you know, just get out and film. I mean, I got caught up in the whole, when I first started out, the whole 16mm and blah, blah, blah. And I think video has completely usurped that old, it's kind of like the old pot and alcohol debate. It's like the old film and video. I mean, everything you see, like the remake of I Spit on Your Grave is a fantastic movie that was shot on video. I didn't even realize it till somebody told me, you know, like 8 or 9 months after I'd seen it. Does anybody even think about that anymore when you know, see a really good movie? The question is, was the movie good and did you enjoy it, I think, more than, you know, was it shot on, you know, a Fisher-Price pixel vision camera or, you know, 80mm or whatever, you know?
I agree. So what is the role of a producer, and how does one go about finding one? And if self-produced, then how is the project financed?
Well, the role of producer, I think, is a precarious line, and it's a big definition. There's different types of producers. There's producers who simply come up with the money and an idea and say, you know, they hire the talent. There's producers who are very active in a movie. They're involved with casting. They're on the set. Usually they're getting in your way and slowing you down. Sometimes a producer is a director. I've worked with producers before, and I've never really had a terrible experience. At the end of the day, you have to do what they tell you, even if you don't agree with what they're saying or the idea or the title of a movie. I mean, the biggest issue I've ever had with the producers I worked with was picking a decent title. They tend to want to pick the dumb titles, and it's the no-brainers, you know. They don't want people to have to think when they read a title. So, but, you know, I prefer to pay for the movies myself, because at the end of the day, only I have to answer. I have to look in the mirror and say, it's your fault this movie's terrible, not have someone else tell me it's my fault it's terrible.
Right, but doesn't that leave you in the lurch in terms of, you know, financial?
No, not really, because, you have to scale your vision down a little, but after you made 30 or so movies, or as many movies as Tim's made, you learn how to do something cheaply but make it look bigger than what it really is.
Right.
That comes with time. So your budget can hamper you a little, but it shouldn't kill your idea. You just have to find a creative way of pulling it off. The most money I've ever spent on a movie is $12,000.
Which really, by industry terms, is nothing. Even in the 70s, that was minuscule.
Yeah, I mean, it's an embarrassing amount of money. I wish it was $120,000, but it wasn't. But still, you find a way to make the film. That particular movie was financed by an outside company, and they were very happy with what they got. They couldn't believe, you know, they probably thought we wouldn't do it or couldn't do it. But, you know, at our level, budget is it's almost a secondary thing rather than the first priority. Tim may think otherwise, but that's my take on it. And then I have worked with producers who are nothing but pain in the ass from the beginning to the end, but in a good way. You know, they mean well, but they're not always filmmakers or money people. So you're always explaining to them, well, you know, producing a movie is like going to Atlantic City and gambling. You may come back with something, and you may not.
Right. So what do you think, Tim? How do you go about finding a producer? What's the role, and do you prefer to self-finance and produce yourself, or do you prefer to make use of a producer?
Well, again, I definitely agree with what Mark was saying. There's many different kinds of producers. There's line producers who physically just pretty much put the production forward, and they're kind of like production managers, which means they just pretty much run the show with you or a producer calling the shots. There's executive producers, and usually they're the people who, they are the producers that would actually find the money through venture capitalists or, you know, get the money or secure the money through a distributor or whatever it is. I mean, there's a million different producers, but if you're talking the no-budget movie route, I mean, a producer is, usually it's the person also directing it or a good friend of theirs, or, you know, if it's me directing the movie, a good friend of mine, and they end up doing a little bit of everything. I mean, they'll drive to the sub shop to get food for everybody. They'll help put the money together. I mean, they're there doing everything, you know, putting the props together, helping with casting, location securing. They're involved in every aspect of the movie, and that's like a great collaboration when you get a good producer like that. And I've also had producers that didn't, you know, the higher the budget it seems, the more creative differences you will have with producers, because suddenly there's, you know, money at stake.
On the line, right.
partnerships and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So then, you know, it's more of a commercial venture with, it's not the lower budgeted stuff. I mean, if it's below, I mean, what we're talking about, the no budget is really below like $50,000. And I don't know if I'm wrong on this, but a lot of the Asylum movies are probably made in that spectrum. You know, they have a whole, it's like a factory, and they have all these people ready at their machines doing the CGI and the editing, and, you know, they know what they're doing, but they know how much money they're going to make. So they got kind of the best of both worlds, or the worst of both worlds, considering, you know, whatever it is. But where to find a producer? I mean, if you're making a movie, you know, George Romero style, which is, you know, a guy who obviously influenced Mark and I here,
quite a bit, you know, and it, Romero, of course, his stories, he started out in Pittsburgh. Now he's in Canada doing the same thing, kind of started over there. But, I mean, you just have to either a friend or you have to network and find somebody. I mean, every Quentin Tarantino needs a Lawrence Bender to kind of bounce those ideas off and keep things propelled ahead. I mean, that's true to an extent, but then sometimes if you don't have access to that, then suddenly you just, you know, you have to do it all yourself, or you have to kind of find people around you that can do, that have talent in different areas that ordinarily a producer would do. But if each person does, like, say you meet one person who does, you know, is good with casting, and another one who knows the locations, and you can also give them, you know, producing credit while also saying, you did the casting, the locations, you secured this, you did the insurance, you did that. Money aspect of it, I mean, that just depends, again, on the circumstances. If you're doing it yourself, you know, you'll be self-financing it, and you'll be very conscious of, you know, not overstepping boundaries that you don't have. In other words, spending money you don't have. So you got to make sure, you got to make cuts in your script, you got to figure out a way to improvise and adapt and show stuff as affordably as possible while maintaining, you know, some kind of vision. And that's, again, you just kind of learn by doing it. And I think you asked earlier, there's a lot of different resources out there on the internet.
Right.
There's websites, there's Facebook. Books I would recommend, one of them would be The Making of Last House on the Left. John Russo has written a bunch of books on making films and, you know, independent movies for very low amount of money. You can probably find those on Amazon. And I'm thinking about writing a book with some of these kind of tips as well. So, and again, you just go on like Amazon and you type in underground, independent, low-budget filmmaking, whatever, and you'll see all kinds. I mean, there was even one that I read, Making Movies at Used Car Prices, and that's when I started. You know, I read these books, and that's pretty much, I took what these people that have done these kind of movies wrote about, and I would just apply them to my circumstances and then do a project, and that's, in essence, is producing. So, you know, and
right.
The money part of a producer usually doesn't say, if you say, here's a producer, I wish this was true, hey, here's $100,000, go ahead and make this movie. It just doesn't work like that on the low budget end of stuff. I wish it did, though. So I don't know if there's any producer you can find that would have pockets full of cash, you know?
Right, you basically answered it between the two of you, but that was kind of my question. It's like, you know, does every Kevin Smith need a Scott Mosier or something like that? But
right.
Isn't it?
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with the Indie Directors Roundtable with Mark Maloney and Tim Ritter. Coming up next, actors versus non-actors, liability insurance, and filming on location. I'm with you on Third Eye Cinema.
Features to my credit. I'm so happy to be on Gene's show here and hope you guys listen. And if there's any independent filmmakers or film students, I think you might learn a lot. And I'll try not to do too much BS because Gene's such a nice guy. So please, please enjoy the show.
This is Bill Rabane, retired and retarded, talking to Third Eye Cinema. Did a nice job on that interview. That was certainly a good one.
Hey, this is Michael Rosso. You may know me from Kinky Kong, Lord of the G-Strings, or Spider Babe, but right now I'm listening to Third Eye Cinema Podcast. Awesome, man.
Hi, this is Nadav Rachol from Pink Egg Inc. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey guys, this is Rick Sloan. I am the guy who actually made Hobgoblins, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema. I'll give you another one for Vice Academy. Hi, this is Rick Sloan. I'm the guy who made all six Vice Academy films, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. I do have 14 movies, but that's probably the two everyone knows.
I know. Well, you know, that's what, seven, eight of them right there.
Yes. You know, there's something when half your career is all sequels.
Hi, this is Richard Gabay, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Hey, I'm listening to it too, so I better shut up so you can get back to the show.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, one of the homes for highbrow interview entertainment.
So speak to the use of actors versus non-actors. You know, what are the advantages and disadvantages of using trained actors, since the negatives are fairly obvious, and, you know, feel free to share any amusing stories, but what are the positives of using friends and acquaintances instead?
Well, you know, again, you want the best person for the role. That's always the bottom line. That may be your friend, and it may be someone you need an audition. The thing about using friends and family is that, you know, they're always there and they're reliable. You know their background. You know their psyche. The last thing you need on a low-budget set is a prima donna that slows
right.
things down and causes trouble every single step of the way. The thing is, they're not trained, you know, friends and family aren't always trained actors.
Right.
And some roles demand experience and, you know, trained actors. And I've worked with both on both sides, and I don't think there's anything bad about either side that you take, because you're going to get something. The question you have to ask yourself, is it what I want?
Right.
You know, you can get really credible roles out of people who've never acted because they're being sincere and being themselves.
Right.
You can also get terrible performances out of these people because they're not used to the film world and what it takes to, you know, make a film and repeating shots over and over and emphasizing certain things that you want. You know, trained actors know how to do that. They know how to act for the screen.
Right.
Sometimes if you get theater actors in your movie, you have to constantly remind them, film is a close medium. There's not someone sitting 600 feet away trying to hear you, so you don't have to yell every line that you say.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes you can have issues with trained actors. I've worked with some actors who have been on some big films, and luckily for me, I've never had any real issues with any actor on either side. I've been very fortunate, but I have heard horror stories of people who really have gotten ground down by actors one way or another. And on low-budget movies like this, once you start shooting with them, you shoot 3 days, and all of a sudden they decide they don't like it anymore, you can't stand them, you've got to find a way to make it work, because, you know, you could have 70% of your movie shot and have key scenes left to do. You need these people, you know?
Right.
So it's a fine line.
And it's funny, too, because, you know, you were mentioning about theater actors, and it reminded me of the talkies from the 30s and the late 20s, because I love those films, but they're so stagey, and the people are clearly acting to the last row of the theater when they've got a camera right on top of them and a boom mic. So I know exactly what you're talking about. You need to look no further than the films from the early 30s to see exactly what you're referring to there. So what do you think, Tim?
Definitely agree with Mark. Not too much really to add, because, again, it depends on your circumstances. And I know I was at a convention with Joe Bob Briggs, and he was doing a seminar on no-budget and low-budget filmmaking. And he got up and he said, no matter what, never put your friends or family. They're terrible, and, you know, they're going to ruin your movie, and you're going to be deceived to just let everything slide, and you're going to make a terrible movie. And to some extent, that's true. And then on the other hand, sometimes you find that a friend or a family member has an extreme talent, or if this goes back to, again, Steven Spielberg doing Jaws, I think I probably read the Jaws log too many times. That's another book I recommend that people read that want to make any kind of movie, especially horror, but any kind of movie at all, because it just gives you the daily grind of making these things and the determination that it takes to make any movie. It'll inspire you. But he cast a lot of local people in parts that they were in real life. In other words, like a mechanic is a mechanic. A guy who drives a yacht is a captain, and they've got a captain to play a captain. So in the same way that Texas Chainsaw Massacre did that, too. They just used local people and roles that were kind of, you know, what they were in real life. And if you can pull that off in the scene, I mean, that works beautifully more times than not. And, of course, there is a case where somebody, you know, they're looking at the camera, they're wagging their tongue, they're like going, you're like, oh, boy, this person is terrible. You end up cutting or wasting all. But you just keep shooting. You know, I would never, you know, and that's the other thing is if you do try this, don't
you know, embarrass the person and tell them they're terrible and lose your temper. I mean, you just shoot it and then later, you know, you either have to reshoot it and cut it or whatever, but you never, if somebody's really giving it a shot for you because somebody didn't show up and you're throwing somebody in there, I mean, you just roll with it and have fun with it. And even if you're losing a little bit of money or whatever, you just, you know, try to be as nice as you can be and get something out of it. You never know. I've used scenes with that have gone exactly like that, and I'm like going, you know, when you get into editing, you're like, you know, I can use this for this incredible flashback scene or this quick, you know, blur of something. And then in the editing, you never know what you might be able to use that sequence for, even if it's just a real quick shot with some sound effects or whatever. So,
Very true.
It's definitely a mixture of both, and, you know, you just go for it and, you know, see what happens. You know, it just depends, again, on your budget and your needs and who doesn't show up. It's always good to have family members. But, you know, one thing about all this is it's really a good idea. I would just mention this, you know, for everybody making a movie. If you're going to use your sister or your mom or whoever in your movie, do an audition with them beforehand. Tape it. Look back at it with them. If they're halfway decent, maybe you can work with them and maybe even get some kind of, you know, somebody, another actor or something to work with them to get, I know a lot of my movies, I would have Joel Weinkoop, who's a pretty good actor. He would go in there and then, you know, if somebody wasn't getting something while I was setting shots up, I would like tell Joel, I'd say, hey, go work with this person and, you know, do a little bit of coaching, see what you can get out of them. And more times than not, you know, you can get what you need out of them. And it's not like any of these movies are winning, you know, Academy Awards and that sort of thing. So it is what it is, you know. So,
and it's
have fun
and
with
it. Again, it comes down to making use of what you got, being flexible, and you brought up an important point there, having respect for these people. Because, yeah, they're not trained actors, and they are pitching in for you, basically, to help you out because they're friends, their family, whatever. So you've got to recognize that they might have some limitations. You can get what you want out of them, hopefully. But, you know, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. So what? You know, you can fix it in the editing booth or, you know, redo it, whatever you got to do. But you don't want to be making enemies out of people that, you know, basically are helping you out. So that's actually a very good point. Now, a related point to this, when using trained actors, is this considered like a non-union job, or do you have to deal with the usual SAG and technicians union, you know, the strong-arm tactics that you go through when you're on a bigger budget feature?
You know, I can say, yeah, short answer, I've never had to deal with that. I've worked with union actors who will work on, you know, they get these waivers where they can work on low-budget movies, but, you know, you got to be making a pretty sizable budgeted film to have to deal with paying, like, union wages and overtime,
right,
and Social Security. And I mean, I could probably say from my experience, I would find that to be a huge hassle on a film at our level. It wouldn't be worth it, to be quite honest. I can't even afford the pain to my own Social Security, let alone someone else.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, especially if you're, you know, like we're kind of discussing the underground and independent and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to, unless you're trying to get, you know, a celebrity of some kind of a hook. In other words, you know, if you're trying to get, say, Linnea Quigley or Debbie Rochon or whatever, and they'll usually work with you, you know, with their agent and everything. And like Mark said, they'll just waiver this or waiver that. And you just want to do it with the least amount of hassle possible. But, I mean, if you're, you know, once you get up to a couple hundred thousand, if you're doing a movie of that level, then you might, I mean, you might be able to have a percentage because there's so many rules and regulations and red tape, you know, when doing,
right,
you know, utilizing SAG that it's not something you really want to worry about at the no-budget level, that's for sure.
Exactly.
So.
And playing off that, what sort of legal issues do you have to be aware of making these kind of films? You know, do you bring in a lawyer to draft up contracts, or do you have a boilerplate you just adapt to the specific person and dollar amount? Because I'm assuming you also have some sort of hold harmless clause relating to either workplace injury claims or indemnifying yourself in the production against these people coming back after you for imagined profits on the final film. You know, what do you have to know before you go into this?
Well, I would honestly laugh if someone tried to sue me for profits from a film because I'd like to see some of that myself from some of these distributors. But typically what I do is we explain the situation. Hey, this is a really low-budget movie. This is our release form. This says you're giving us your permission to be in the movie and use you in advertising, and I'm promising you that I'm not going to paste your head on some naked girl's body and make some other weird movie out of this. And you can pay them a daily rate, which we've done sometimes, or you can give them back-end money, which which I just wrote $1,000 in checks today to some actors from a film we made last year because we promised them that's what we would do, and you have to uphold that commitment. So they know that you're sincere. They'll work with you again, or if you stiff them, then they'll just tell everyone they know, don't work with these guys. They don't pay, right. You know. So you've got to follow through on whatever deal you set up because they're giving up time, sometimes without pay or little, and you want to compensate them however you can. And you have to uphold that agreement. We've never had a serious injury on one of my films, although someone burned my porch down. That's a long story we won't get into right now. You know, we've had people fall and cut themselves, and, you know, it's usually, oh, you're okay, yeah, we'll get you a Band-Aid, and we go on. But, you know, you have to be careful. You have to be careful that you have location permits, because if you're shooting somewhere and you're not supposed to, you know, and there's something distinguishable in the background, the movie gets released, someone sees it, you know, they can make they're not going to take you to, you know, the cleaners, but they can make life difficult for you, and you just want to get that stuff taken care of so there's no surprises. I edited a show for a company out in California a year ago, and they filmed in an alley, and across the street there's a giant food chain. You know, the logo's just right there in the center of the frame. So, you know, you spend a week taking that out because, you know, there's error and omissions insurance that these companies pay for specifically those kind of stupid, frivolous lawsuits. So
right. It's
really strange. You want to cover yourself as best you can, but, you know, if you hire an attorney to help you make all that right, you'll never get a movie made.
So what do you think, Tom?
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, Mark's dealt with the same exact things that I've dealt with here, and attorneys are expensive. If you have a family attorney that will work for cheap or nothing and will consult with you, that's all the better. But when putting the movie together, if you have budget, I would say any kind of money, even if you're getting your friends and family members and, you know, and if you're getting outside funds, I would say definitely put together a little limited partnership, have it notarized, get everything in writing no matter what. Deal memos, release forms for all your actors and actresses. Make sure they specifically know, like Mark said, you know, what you're going to be utilizing them for, how they're going to be used in the marketing and advertising. And if you do decide to pace their head on something they might not like, make sure you get that in writing so there's nothing in the future that they can come after you. And like Mark said, on my movies, we've never had any major accidents either. Safety is of paramount concern, especially on my little movie. I'm like, you know, a lot of people will make fun of me. They're like going, you know, I can do this or that. You know, I can jump off that. It's only 5 feet. I'm like, going, no, we're not going to do that. I'm going to find a way to cheat it because, you know what, there's a lot of horror stories out there where people have been hurt on movies, because especially if you're using weapons or knives, and even if they're not really that sharp, you can have a lot of things go on. And I know many cases where actors and actresses have been hurt on these things, and no movie is worth, you know, getting hurt over. And
exactly.
Sadly, though, it can just be something simple, like in life. You stepping out of the shower and fall. And same thing can apply, you know, with any sequence. Somebody could trip over a wire or fall, fall from a cord that's not tied down properly or something you didn't see. So another piece of advice is also get some kind of insurance through your production company, if possible. And these days, I mean, it'll just help you. And, I mean, in other words, if you have a production company, talk to your insurance company, like even if it's through your car company, they'll be able to direct you in your state to different companies that provide different liability insurances for independent video producers. Even these days, even wedding videographers have to have, you know, different kinds of insurance for shooting their stuff. So, and, of course, like Mark said, all this stuff completely adds up, and suddenly you can find yourself insurance broke. But it's always good to be aware of all this, be aware of safety, and cover yourself with, you know, as many contracts and as many forms as you can. And again, there's different books on independent filmmaking where you can view this kind of material. And these days, like with the internet, you just go on Dr. Google, type in actors deal memo, a million of them will come up. You can tailor that for yourself, for your production, and write all this stuff yourself. And that's what another thing that producers do is they keep track of all this paperwork. They write this paperwork. They have it checked with an attorney. In other words, you can write up all this stuff yourself,
then taken into a lawyer for, you know, whatever he's charging, and say, can you just verify all this, look at it, and in other words, he's not writing it up for you, but he's double-checking it for you and going, okay, yep, you got all your T's crossed and all your I's dotted. You might want to add this, you might want to add that, and, you know, you're not destroying your entire budget because, you know, lawyers are probably $200, $300 an hour, so...
Right.
So I would say, yeah, definitely cover your bases with all this stuff, you know, as much as possible. Distribution, again, the errors and omission, like Mark was saying, if you're shooting outside, these days I try to do everything on private property, you know, when possible, because if you're shooting in the city, no matter what permits you have, if you're shooting a horror movie and it gets played, say, on the Science Fiction Channel, and you have McDonald's in the background, and McDonald's doesn't like the theme of your movie, you know, it's about cannibals. They're going to come after you and go, hey, you can't show this, and they're going to sue you. So there's a million things to think about. And then on the other hand, you got to understand also that it depends on what you're going to do with the movie. If you're just going to put it on YouTube, or if you're just trying for a very small, you know, audience, and you've got a $5,000 budget or whatever, you need not worry about it as much, because you could just worry yourself into not making the movie. So there's kind of a strange balance that you have to, a tightrope that you have to walk on. And the red tape part of it, I absolutely hate it, but it's unfortunately it's something that you gotta face and you gotta deal with every production. So
it's kind of uncanny that you picked this up already, Mark, but this is where I was going to go next. How about locations? While a lot of these appear to be filmed in backyards or the woods, there's also a number of street scenes, scenes inside schools and businesses, and special locations. So I'm guessing that if you are shooting out there, you go out on recce, you know, scouting for the right location for the proper setting and feel. And how do you wind up securing permission for these? You know, do people just okay your use as long as you don't break anything? Or do you have to pay for the use of a given location, or maybe provide a promotional tie-in to benefit their business, or worse, give them a part in the film?
You know, again, it varies. Some of the locations I shoot on, like Tim said, it's private property. I know the owners. If not, you approach them, say, look, here's what I'm doing. I'd like to use your yard. Your building might be in the background. Do you have a problem with that? You know, you have to have location release forms, too, if someone agrees to it. You always have to be mindful when you're on their property that you don't break something. You leave it better than what it looked like when you got there. That's my motto. Occasionally, we have to pay for a location. You know, luckily, it won't kill you, at least at our level, because we're never there long enough to spend too much of a fortune. And we just shot a movie, Queen Crab, and we had to have a redneck bar, and we found a bar that was perfect for what we wanted. And I remember walking in, it was the scariest thing I ever did in my life, because it's just like the movies, you know. These two blue-collar guys walk in, and it's like people playing pool, and they stop, and, like, everyone looks at you, like, we're here to see the owner. And, like, everyone's looking at each other like, I don't know, they thought we were fed there to bust them or something. And we ended up playing a horseshoe match with a bunch of bikers, and we got the location, so... And we were going to shoot a commercial for them, and they were the most gracious people you could ever meet. So it just depends. You never, you know, people steal locations, like you jump out of a car and shoot a couple shots of someone on a street. You can get away with that, but you still have to be careful. You still have to be respectful of other people's property, and at all costs, secure their permission. Like Tim said, get it in writing so they can't come back at you later and say it. I didn't know they were doing this. I don't want my location in this movie. But where I live, you know, there's a lot of state land. In Pennsylvania, you do not need a permit to shoot on state land, even though they'll come up and hassle you. You just tell them, oh, this is state land. You don't need a permit because of PA law, such and such and such and such. And then you're usually okay. But again, be respectful, be mindful, ask permission. Get it in writing.
All right. So what do you think, Tim?
No, I agree 100%. It couldn't have been said better. And, I mean, the only thing I would add is that each project, again, is different. And it just, if you need to sneak a shot somewhere where you just pull up. I mean, I found that with the video revolution, the digital video revolution anymore, it's a lot easier to go into locations, public places where... In the old days, if I would have set up a VHS camera or a 16mm camera, man, you would have been like you know, flies at a barbecue. They would have been all over the grill, going, "Hey, what are you doing? What's going on? What are you permitting?" These days, now it's like, you know, everybody's got a camera. people are shooting everywhere with their iPhones and their whatever they've got these days. I mean, it's very commonplace. If like for Deadly Dares, for instance, we got permission to shoot in front of this big building in the middle of the city. Basically, we showed up on a Sunday, and if you're not doing anything disruptive, you really don't even worry about it. It's just people having conversations or whatever, and that's what it was. It was just dialogue. These days, people are just really, really, really cool about it because it's just part of America anymore, you know, probably part of the entire world where everybody's got some kind of camera or something. So I would say if you're not doing anything too crazy, you don't have that much to worry about, and also that you definitely want to clear the images in the background and make sure you just don't shoot something that, like I said, if you're making a cannibal movie and you got some major corporation in the background, say one of the big banks that helped cause the global recession there in the background, you know, they're going to come after you. They're going to think you did it on purpose. As a matter of fact, I might have done it on purpose, but, you know, it is what it is. You just got to use common sense, get your release forms, and, you know, do the best you can. And there's always a case where, you know, sometimes you got to do the Robert Rodriguez, you know, Rebel Without a Crew routine. If you really need something, you know, you just got to kind of sneak a shot sometimes and take a chance with it. But don't be surprised if it comes back to haunt you at some time, you know. So.
Right.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema on the In the Director's Roundtable with Tim Ritter and Mark Colonia. Coming up next, we talk location, timing, editing, and post-production. And you're on Third Eye Cinema.
I'm Giovanni Lombardo Radice. You might know me with my stage name of John Morgan. I've been in many horror movies through the years, working with masters of the genre like Fulci, Margheriti, Diodato, and Lenzi. So you are listening to Third Eye Cinema, and I hope you will enjoy.
It was hard not to laugh out loud when you said that about Lenzi.
And I can't name Lenzi without underlining somehow my feelings, you know. Stronger than myself. I can't help it.
Hi, everybody. I am Grand Master of Martial Arts. My name is Y.K. Kim. Person who loves martial arts, live with martial arts, and breathe with martial arts. That is Y.K. Kim. I am a Grand Master of Martial Arts, and at the same time, I'm a producer and director, writer and actor in the Miami Connection. And I truly enjoyed talking with Gene, Third Eye Cinema. Thank you.
Hi, this is Tim Lucas, the editor of Video Watchdog magazine. And when I'm recovering from a cold, I like to recover with a nice hot toddy and a good listen to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, guys and girls. My name is Nico Mastorakis. And if it's all Greek to you, Google me. I have written, produced, and directed several movies. Not all of them good movies, some of them very good movies. But more interesting than the movies themselves is a lengthy interview at Third Eye Cinema. If you miss it, you don't like movies.
This is Roberta Finlay, citizen of New York, devout listener of Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, this is Tim Ritter, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, home of underground filmmakers and artists, so take a listen. It's well worth your time.
Do you develop a tight script and storyboard, or do you prefer to more or less wing it? And are these scripts outsourced, as in your case, Mark, with the three movies that John Oak Dalton did for you, or do you mainly write your own scripts and dialogue?
It depends. I mean, I've given people ideas, they've come back with a script, I've given people really detailed notes and an outline down to character names, some dialogue, and they come back and we alter it. Sometimes I see it from concept to finished script. As far as detailed planning on movies like this, it's a must. I mean, because there's so much working against you that you have to be flexible and be open to new ideas and be able to adapt, but you can't just walk onto a set the first day and say, okay, guys, we're going to shoot something. I'm not sure. Sit down for 30 minutes and I'll figure it out. No, 30 minutes later, you better have two scenes shot. You know, there's just not... You don't have that kind of time because you're dealing with people that are giving up their time, and the last thing you want to do is waste it. And the more prepared you are, the more efficient you are, and the smoother the production goes. So I do storyboard sometimes, not always. It depends on the sequence, if it's complex, if there's complex camera moves that require certain blocking. I will storyboard and stick to it, but shoot alternative footage too, because complex sequences take time to figure out, and the last place to start figuring it out is when you're right there surrounded by people looking at you, wondering what you're going to do next or what they should be doing. So you're only helping yourself by being more prepared. So, you know, dialogue scenes, they're pretty easy, but, you know, you may have special circumstances where you're blocking a moving shot and the dialogue's occurring through a scene rather than two people in a stationary position. But some people don't use storyboards at all. Some people draw stick figures, little tiny detailed maps. I'm kind of middle of the road. My drawing skills aren't great, but I think my storyboards look a little bit better than the Raging Bull ones that I saw.
How about you, Tim?
I would agree again with Mark. I think we agree on everything here. I think we've done this too long. Middle of the road, it just depends on, you know, again, the project. Always come prepared. With Truth or Dare, we storyboarded pretty much the whole movie. Bigger movies, I mean, Hitchcock, if you're inspired by him then, and you're a good artist, then by all means, if you can do that, then go ahead and storyboard your entire movie. As a matter of fact, if you're not a good artist, something else to consider to get you started in the business, you know, once you have that project you're on fire about is Video Maker Magazine. Read that religiously. Subscribe to it. They'll give you tips in there. There's computer programs you can buy for like $100 or less, and you can essentially do your storyboards professionally using their stuff. You can set it all up, and they're very time-consuming and stuff, but you can, even if you're a terrible drawer like me, drawer, and that's like that's a word, terrible artist, if you're a terrible artist, you know, stick figures, and you'll like that. And I've done both. I've done had professional storyboards drawn up. I've done stick figures. And, you know, the movies like Deadly Dares, when I come to the set, it's usually what I do now is I have a detailed script, of course, and then you tear the script apart and, you know, you don't shoot. Usually you don't shoot in sequential order at all. You try to shoot everything. In other words, like if you have a barn, you're going to shoot all the barn scenes at one time. If you have a school, you're going to shoot all the school scenes at one time. So it continuity really can get screwball. There's another good word, screwball. Continuity can get really difficult to keep track of. I'm kind of inventing words tonight. That's pretty good. That's another computer program we need to work on, I think. but no, seriously, you just need to just find your pace, and if you do like the storyboards, do it. One thing to remember is if you really are a hardcore storyboard person and suddenly you lose that location, your storyboards are going to be completely useless. So, I would say have a backup plan and be able to direct without storyboards as well, especially if you're doing this kind of thing. What I usually do is I'll just go through the scenes for the day. If we're shooting, usually I try to shoot 10 pages a day on a no-budget, low-budget movie, and I will have the order that I'm going to shoot everything, and I will write extensive notes for the entire thing. I'll say, I want a close-up shot here. This shot's going to be panning back and forth. We're going to go over here and get this establishing shot. Then I'm going to do this and then that. I mean, you just, like Mark said, when you arrive on the set, you're setting up and you're doing your thing because time is money and people are looking at you, and you got to just get going and get what's shot, because it's amazing how fast time goes when you're at a location. You know, it'll be 5 hours goes like 5 minutes, and you're like, if you're not actually getting stuff shot, you know, you're never going to finish the movie. And that's another problem with doing these things. You really got to pace yourself just to to shoot, because a lot of times you feel you're not even getting your script when you're shooting, because it's going so fast. You're like going, I got to get this shot. I got to capture it. Okay, we're going to run over here. Oh, man, we're going to run over there. Another thing is try to get as much as you can out of one location. In other words, this is another thing for Deadly Dares. We found a big piece of private property that a friend of mine had a pool, it had a field, it had woods, it had a house. I mean, so for just one location was actually like 10 locations in the movie. So that's another thing you can do, shortcut. So, yeah, so that's another thing that you can consider doing. And these are just like little shortcuts when you're trying to do. Because, again, time is money. If you're driving 30 miles or 60 miles for one scene, and then you're like, okay, the next scene's going to be 3 hours down the road, you're going to spend all your time traveling and waste all that gas money. So that's pretty much what I would say.
Mark, were you about to say something there?
That's great advice, Tim. I mean, you know, you can get a lot out of one location, and there's nothing worse than spending a half a day driving somewhere, you know, and then, you know, you start with four cars, and when you get to the location, there's only two and a half behind you. It's, you know, it's wasting time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the nice thing about shooting in the woods is you find a nice spot, you plant your camera down, and every 15 degrees you have a new setup.
So
yep. It's
actually uncanny, because once again, now it's Tim that went there. But you anticipated exactly where I was going to go, and you might have answered some of this already. But let's talk timing. Now, I'm assuming you do have some sort of a shooting schedule with a start and end date. So how fast do these productions run? Do you have to deal with the sort of endless setup issues typical of the Hollywood-style films and television? Or can you get a lot in the can within a single day?
Oh, you have to get a lot in the can. I mean, yeah, neither one of us, you know, we don't have all day to light one close-up. You know,
right.
And in a Hollywood set, that's exactly what can happen. They'll light a close-up, they'll shoot it, break for lunch, they'll do a reversal, and that's their day. I mean, you know, I've shot movies in 2.5-3 days, and I've shot movies in 8 days, but no matter what the time is, you have to get 10-15 pages done a day. And we're not talking, you know, we're not talking just the dialogue. You got to cover action, you got to cover establishing shots, you know, all the things that when you get into editing, you go, you know, this movie takes place in a house, but there's no establishing shots. There's no exterior. You know, you need all that stuff for the audience to follow the story. And you know, it's easy when you're on a location to forget something. You know, it's in your mind, but so much happens that you forget that one shot you really need, or you didn't get another take of it and you should have. Time is your worst enemy on a low-budget movie. It's not always money, but it's time, because, you have to set a momentum, and once that momentum gets killed, whether it's equipment failure, outburst from an actor, or a crew member who's not doing what they're supposed to and they ruined your whole day's sound, you know, those things will torpedo a low-budget movie quicker than anything you could ever imagine. So, yeah, you have to have a plan. You've got to keep the movie rolling. They look to the director as kind of the spearhead of the project. They can't see you getting angry, yelling at people. You know, you don't get quality work out of people you scream at.
Sure.
I mean, I've seen it. I've never done it. I've been on a set where I saw a screaming match between two or three people, and it ruined the whole day. I mean, you could just feel it, you know. It's not a way to get the best out of somebody. So, yeah, I mean, it's like a train. Once it starts rolling, it can't stop until you get to the destination. On one of our pictures, that's the last day of the shooting, the last shot. That's when the train has to stop.
Now, Tim, you sort of already touched on this, but do you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I would say everything's pretty much been covered. I mean, you just, you know, do the best you can with. I mean, when I first started reading about movie making and everything, one of the first things I read, I think, in a Sid Field book on screenwriting was one page of script translates to 1 minute of completed footage in your movie. And I kind of laughed at that. Over the years, over 25, 30 years now, whatever it's been, I found that that's been completely true. Kind of crazy. It's like even when you're editing and you skip pages and this and that and you make adjustments, if I look at the page 80 of the script, I'm like at the 79-minute mark on the movie. It's always really, really, really close. But, yeah, for low-budget movies and no-budget movies, I mean, we got to move. You got to go fast. You got tons of setups. I think Jim Warnarski just did a movie for, like, 3 days. He's shooting them in, like, 3 days now, some of these movies. So it's like, you know, the 3 days in a Hollywood movie, you'd get 30 seconds of footage. So it's just hit the ground running and never stop and 15-hour days, and you pretty much, you know, you just shoot endlessly to get the movie done. So really, like I said, I try to do about 10 pages a day, which is like 10 minutes of footage, and you ask how long. Usually it's a 10 to 12-day shooting schedule is what I try to do. But sometimes that can be over a period of, you know, if you're like what they call the weekend warriors, where, say, you shoot Friday, Saturday, or Saturday and Sunday. So, you know, it might go over a period of like 2 or 3 months. But generally you should be able to get like a 100-page script shot in like 12 days or less, and, you know, at this level. So that's what I would shoot for. Although if you're doing something more complicated, you can cut that back. You know, if you're doing it yourself and you say, look, I want to take more time, and you have the cast and the attention span. The other thing is, how long can you keep this group of people together? So right. That's probably one reason why both Mark and I are saying, you know, when the train goes, you got to go, because it's really difficult to keep people that you're paying either nothing or a very low amount for over a period of, say, you're like, hey, I'm going to shoot this movie over the entire summer. We're going to do it on weekends, or we're going to shoot 2 pages on Saturday and 2 pages on Sunday, and this is going to go on for months. The problem is you're going to lose a lot of people along the way, a lot of your leads, and that's a good way to make a project fall apart. So you want to do it as quickly and professionally as possible. And again, like Mark was saying, no, you know, be nice to everybody and let everybody have input. It's collaboration. It's not, you're not, you know, as a director, you're not a tyrant. You know, you're not the last word. You use everybody's ideas for the good of the project, and sometimes they have better ideas than you, and that's the whole job of a director, is to just kind of take all the best ideas and then make a decision on what to do, and to do it professionally and calmly. You know, and if something happens where everybody's stressed out, you're the one who has to be talking like I'm talking right now, in a very matter-of-fact, cool tone, like you're not screaming and yelling, and just, you know, you kind of diffuse anything that happens where, you know, people are at odds with each other and that kind of thing. You just keep the thing rolling and finish as quickly and professionally as possible.
I'll actually follow on what you both just said and say that anybody out there that wants to know what it's like to actually be a director as opposed to just being a tyrant, you need to check out Francois Truffaut's, the real title is L'Ennui Americain, but it comes over here as Day for Night. And it's exactly what you guys are both just talking about. It's all the chaos that can happen on a set, and yet you have this benevolent director who takes all the things that happen and everybody's input and makes it work. It's not standing there and saying, you do this, you do that, otherwise I'm going to fire you, I'm going to scream at you. It's a collaborative process, and that's what makes a movie work, and that's what makes a movie finish, as opposed to these projects that derail and these vanity projects that just don't work. And I really think that is an important issue to hammer home. Now, you guys have both answered this one already, but I'm going to put it out there in case anybody missed it. I was going to say that I'm assuming that you both use the typical film method, where any and all scenes requiring a given setting or location are filmed out of sequence so that you can get in and out of that particular area and move on, or do you actually film in a more linear fashion? And both of you have said what I assume, where, you know, you get a location, you milk it for all it's worth, and then you move on. And that's actually smart. It's good for the budget. So how about editing? Do you, as the directors and possibly scripters or at least storyboarders of the film, feel that you're the best, if not the only person qualified to handle this job? Or do you farm it out to someone else? Because that'll mean more money to sink into the project. And you don't necessarily know how well the outside person will or will not understand and adhere to your personal vision for the project. So what do you think?
I'm probably like Tim. I always edit my own films, because a lot of times being an editor, I mean, I've edited 60 movies outside of the things I've shot. You have a very clear idea when you're making a movie as a director, when you have enough footage. When Hollywood directors, most of them, they'll shoot one scene from 100 angles because 90% of them don't understand editing. So they just want to make sure they're safe.
Right.
I don't do that. I know it takes time. You're eating up more footage. I may only shoot a master partway through because I know I'm going to cut to this. I know I'm going to cut to that. And when I write the script, I already see it in my head. It's already almost edited. I just have to shoot it somewhat based on what I saw and then put it together. I don't think I've ever let anyone outside of my brother or I edit one of the films we've made, probably because they get the footage and wouldn't know what the hell it was all about to begin
right,
with.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes the director is the best especially on a low-budget movie, the director is the best person to edit it because they kind of have to make this movie in a certain way that, you know, a standard editor might not understand. You know, they may be looking for, okay, where's the rest of this master shot? And they'll spend a half a day looking for it, and it's not there. And, you know, most editors, they need slates. I don't always slate because, you know, if I'm going to edit it, I make notes in my script, so I kind of know where things are. That would drive an editor crazy. And I know because I've edited movies before that weren't mine that didn't have slates. I mean, even with a script, I was having a hard time following it. So, in the same breath, you know, I've edited movies from other filmmakers that, I mean, I'm sure when they shot it, they didn't know how they were going to edit it, but you edit it, send them a cut. They give you notes. You do what you can to change it, and it becomes a collaboration. Based on experience, they're not always happy with some of the decisions you make, even though editorially, there's no other way to do it because they crossed the line when they were shooting. There's continuity gaps that you have to edit around, things they may not be looking for. So it's just a fine balance, I think. On low-budget movies, I think the director typically is the editor. I could be wrong.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like Mark said, a lot of times you're shooting something a specific way, and it may be that nobody can figure out except you, you know, how the puzzle all goes together. Because each little scene you shoot, each little sequence, each little snippet, each little shot, whatever you want to call it, it's a puzzle. And these little pieces of the puzzle in the editing room are all going to be put together. And if you have to explain to an editor how all these pieces fit together, sometimes just trying to explain it to them, you're going to completely lose them. So you might as well just do it yourself. As a matter of fact, with Deadly Dares, I had an editor ready to go, you know, to do the movie and you know, actually put it together, and it just didn't work out because, first of all, he was so busy. And I don't know if a lot of people know this or not, but editing is, you know, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I'll edit, da, da, da. But it is such a time-consuming
right
thing. I mean, and to expect somebody to edit a movie for free or very, you know, for a couple $100 or whatever, or a copy of the movie is ludicrous because the amount of time you spent, I think for Deadly Dares, for the rough cut, I think I spent like 700 hours editing the movie. That's how long it took. So, I mean, it's, and I actually kept track because I was like, because when the editing deal didn't work out, finally the editor told me, and he's a professional editor, he's done, you know, big feature films on the red format and everything else. He said, sometimes, he goes, you know, I couldn't have done what you did because you shot it, you have the vision. It's just like Mark said, only you knew how it would go together. So, you know, this version had to be done by you. And now we have another editor doing like an HD version. So hopefully that works out and he brings some new stuff to the table. But you really needed that first cut so people could see how it all came together, because a lot of times people won't be able to tell that it's going to make any kind of sense at all, because, again, with this one, we had such a small crew. We didn't slate anything or anything, so it would be an absolute mess for somebody who, you know, was not there on the set, or who did not know what we were trying to do. So I would say it's probably in the director, producer's best interest for these smaller projects to, you know, edit it yourself. Now, if you're moving up to a larger budget, of course, you know, there's always the collaboration and somebody else's viewpoint, and, you know, at that point, if you're paying people, you know, you might consider it. But I would say the director should always do the rough cut, though, at least so that way everybody can see the way that it's coming together, or at least supervise that rough cut to the point where, you know, you're over somebody's shoulder working with them going, this goes here, that goes here. Oh, that insert goes here. Oh, man, we did see it. Because otherwise, the project, you know, I've had a couple projects come together that I wasn't involved with the editing, and it really comes out much maligned compared to what you had in mind. You're like, well, so I would say definitely get into the spirit of editing. It'll also make you a better filmmaker. It'll make you a better director. It'll make you see more from the actor's perspective. You know, when you're editing everything, you'll be able to understand what an actor needs more as far as, you know, when you're shooting this stuff. So it's, again, if you're passionate about movie making, you're going to want to know about every aspect. You're going to want to do every aspect because it's only going to make your future projects and your future in the business, if that's what you want to do, all the more, you know, more knowledgeable, and you're going to just have a good time doing it, and you're going to know a lot more as far as, you know, the whole way a movie is put together from A to Z.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema and our Indie Directors Roundtable with Mark Maloney and Tim Ritter.
Coming up next, we talk special effects, promotion, distribution, recouping costs on filmmaking. Only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Kind of perversion. As people who love to watch movie after movie after movie, we have that kind of blessed perversion. So take it as a compliment. You are a pervert.
Hi, this is Tim Lucas, the editor at Video Watchdog Magazine, and I'd like to wish you and everyone at Third Eye Cinema a very happy new year.
Hey, this is Michael Rosso from the Alternative Cinema Podcast, and you're listening to the awesome Third Eye Cinema Podcast.
Hello there. I'm Bill Rabane. I'm always listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hey, this is David Heavener from Twisted Justice and I of the Stranger, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hi, everybody. I am Glenn Marshall of Martial Arts. My name is Y.K. Kim. You know, number one, I truly appreciate for your interview. That Third Eye Cinema, you are great interviewer. I could not believe. And I mean, you are great a communicator. It's, you made me so comfortable. That's great. I want everybody at least to once watch my connection. And I really appreciate all audience as listens Third Eye Cinema.
Hello, this is Herschel Gordon Lewis. You may know me from some of my movies, such as Blood Feast or 2000 Maniacs. And you know what I'm doing right now? The same thing you are, listening to Third Eye Cinema. Join me there.
Wow. Those are both fantastic.
Okay, that'll be about $22,000 each.
I see nothing's changed on your end, Herschel.
That's how I live, Gene.
That's it.
This is Arch Hall Jr. of the Choppers, Wild Guitar, and the Sadist. And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia.
And this is Tim Ritter.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Be there or be square.
So special effects, if any, how do you handle these? I mean, beyond the standard ketchup bottle full of gore and a few rubber Halloween masks.
You know, it depends on the movie. You know, some movies have very limited effects. Some movies have bigger effects. You can seek out. There's lots of people out there that are savvy today in prosthetics, in digital special effects. I mean, you can learn a lot of the digital stuff on your own. I'm always teaching myself how to do new and different things. I have acquaintances that are savvy with special effects, so it's never been a real issue, but for someone who doesn't have access to that, go on the internet. Do some search, and you'll find people that have skills, and they're, you know, eager and willing to want to be involved with the production and offer what they can do to help out. In the olden days, that's what I like to call it when we started. You know, we did everything ourselves. My brother John was more of the makeup guy, and I was more of the director putting the production together guy, so it worked out pretty well most of the time. You know, as our productions got bigger, we would have to find other talented people that would be willing to jump on board and help out with that. So there's always resources out there, whether they're physical effects, digital effects, stunts. You know, that's a special effect to some degree. Don't do stunts yourself. Find a trained professional or fake it, because, you know, like Tim said, nothing's worth dying for on a film. Nothing.
So what do you think, Tim?
I would agree wholeheartedly, and again, like Mark has said many times, and like I'm saying, it's different for each project. If you're doing a really, if you're doing a $300 movie, then you're going to be doing the effects yourself, obviously, and you're going to be putting that together at home. You're going to be reading Tom Savini's Grand Illusions book. You're going to be researching Dick Smith on the internet to try to do your practical effects. You're going to be going to Halloween Express and toy stores and trying to, you know, get stuff, props, and flea markets, and do it all yourself. And then there's the other side of it where you might hire an effects person. There are a lot of people coming out of Savini's school, and there's all kinds of, you know, really hungry effects people that want to show their stuff, where, you know, they might do something for just cost and credit so they can get their career started. So maybe some of these effects schools are a good place to, you know, try to seek people in the effects if you've got a few effects in your movie that you really want to look, you know, on the Friday the 13th level or whatever. And then there's the digital domain. And again, like Mark said, you can, you know, you can go out there and find people who are really good at computers or try to learn a little bit of it yourself if you have, you know, a good system and do all that stuff. And these days there's some incredible stuff that's being put out, the digital stuff that's available, the special effects, explosions. I mean, again, this is stuff that in the old days people were doing on Super 8 movies and even VHS or whatever. We're going around, and if there's an explosion scene, you're dealing with gasoline and putting it on there and lighting a match and running. Now, these days, you don't even have to even do that at all. You can do it all digitally, and it's just much, much safer. So safety first, and again, it just depends on, a lot of times, I mean, when you formulate a script, I think we've talked about this before, maybe on one of the other shows, but when you write your screenplay, one of the many things you have to keep in mind if you're planning to direct it yourself in your backyard or in your neighborhood or in your location, you want to write around locations you know you can get. You want to write around areas you know you can get. You want to write around people you know you can get, and the resources around you, you know, in wherever you're located, in your demographic location. And that's the kind of stuff you want to do. And if there's like a stunt where you want somebody falling off a cliff, these days you just got to line the camera up at the bottom of the cliff nicely with a nice, you know, tilted shot, and then later you'll just add it in the special effect with a computer of a body coming over the cliff and, you know, flying down and whizzing past the camera, and add in a couple sound effects in the screen, and you're done. So that's the kind of thing you need to keep in mind when you're actually writing your script. You know, look around and see what's available, and think about how you're going to accomplish everything in your neck of the woods, pretty much. You know, whether it's practical effects, digital effects, or a mixture of both, and who's going to be involved. So that's something that's probably pretty good advice for anybody who's like on their second film or whatever, and they're planning to do more, you know, right in their own neighborhood. So that would be about it.
So let's talk promotion and distribution. This is going to be a kind of a multi-part question. So how do you get these films out there? Assuming you don't already have a relationship set up with a given company or a distribution network, how do you go about finding one? You know, do you cut a trailer and send that around? Do you take the film around to festivals or conventions? Do you have to directly cold call distribution companies and set up and attend screenings with various people on that end to see if they want your film? And how about test screenings? Do you bother? Is there any real point to doing these?
The operation or the way you approach it changes with the times. Obviously, when we started, you'd make your movie and make a bunch of dubs and send a cover letter to tons of companies that were out there, and maybe you'd find one that would take it. Now, today, it's a lot more difficult. 95% of those companies are gone. DVD companies are far and few between anymore. So the biggest retailer of DVDs is Walmart. And, you know, making money or getting your movie into Walmart is, at our level, would not be worth it, because you have to rent space, give them 40,000 copies, and if your movie doesn't do well in the first week, they send you them back, and you're stuck with all this. You know, you've just wasted a fortune. I think the future for filmmakers and people like Tim and I may not be so much in DVD, but is probably heading more towards social media and things of that nature, and digital projection. You know, the independent was squeezed out of the theatrical market real fast in the 80s. That may change. I don't know. It may not, because of the grip that the majors have on theatrical exhibition and distribution. But, you know, like Tim said, there's always a way to find a movie for your audience. I think to be successful, you have to evolve with the technology and find ways to exploit it to your advantage. Yeah, I mean, there's so much more out there, and anyone can get something up on YouTube. But, you know, I think Tim will agree that, I don't make movies just to put up on YouTube. I mean,
right.
I have other artistic aspirations, and you want your movie to be seen by the largest number of people. And I've had screenings. I've taken movies around and shown them. You know, there's a lot of ways you can do that. You can send, and you have to be careful, because anyone who, quote, wants a free movie because they say they're a reviewer, a lot of times they just want a free movie. They could give a crap about writing a review of your movie.
Right.
So, you know, I get lots of requests for screeners. I simply just don't give out. But, you know, you can send trailers to companies. You can call them and say, hey, I got a great movie. I want you to see it. And you can go meet with them. There's a lot of different ways to do it. I think as time goes on, it gets tougher. And, you know, you almost have to be a self-distributor, I think. I think that may be the route we may have to go. Whatever device is there for us to show our movie, we will have to be in control of getting it to that device, to these people, and cut out these middlemen. And it's problematic for a filmmaker. Even at a low budget, you know, you spend whatever you have on a picture, you want to at least get that back, and that's hard to do when oftentimes filmmakers who are lucky enough to get a deal may not be lucky enough to collect what the movie got in returns and royalties and things like that. So.
Right. So what do you think, Tim?
Definitely agree with everything Mark said. And I would say the way I handled it with Deadly Dares is probably the way that is the only way to do it. And even if you're just making your first movie and you're just finishing it up at this time, what I did was I call it the slow burn distribution method. And there's a lot of movie makers that I know that are doing the same thing. And really what you try to do, what is the success of any movie? And that good word of mouth. In other words, people hear about it. They talk about it, they tell their friends about it, they post about it on message forums, on social websites, and then it just propels itself from there. So really, you got to start from nowhere. You go to your local theater, you try to get a midnight showing at a digital cinema, and this is what we did with Deadly Dares. We started out that way. I made up lobby cards. We alerted Fangoria. We got, you know, national publicity of a local showing, a regional showing, connected with other theaters, horror conventions. Will you show this at a midnight showing? Will you show this at your festival? We'll send an actor or an actress there, and we have giveaway stuff. And without breaking the bank with today's, you know, low-cost printing stuff and everything, you know, you create posters, excitement through hats, pins. A lot of the stuff these days is done with the merchandising end, of course, like with Star Wars. And you can do this kind of thing on the lower level as well, you know, on the underground level. T-shirts, you give these things out, you sell them at the showings you do. I know a lot of people are very paranoid about giving away screener copies these days because it'll end up on the BitTorrent site, and, you know, people will pirate it. That is a legitimate issue these days. I tackled that issue by saying, okay, that's fine. What I'm doing right now is it ended up being what I call, for Deadly Dares, the first cut, the underground cut. It's the director's cut. It was meant just to be like a rough cut, but people responded to it so well that I said, all right, let's release this. Let's just give it to, you know, as many people as we can. Let's show it in these theaters with the thought and ambition that down the line we're going to have another cut, you know, a bigger cut on steroids in HD that we're going to release, you know, after a year or a year and a half of hyping it like this. And so far, and then we got SRS Cinema, which I've got a pretty good relationship with over the years. They're going to release the underground cut this December on DVD while it's still playing at, you know, conventions and theaters. And I'm handing out lobby cards and I'm doing interviews. And you're just hoping that this word of mouth catches on, and then you put different sequences on, you know, the streaming sites like YouTube, not the whole movie, but just different scenes. And you hope that, you know, people get excited about that. And you just keep pushing and pushing. And it may lead to something, and then again, it may just, you know, you may end up just, you know, being lucky to break even on a $5,000 or $10,000 budget. So that's the way I would approach it today. And I think what Mark is saying about self-distribution, you're becoming sort of your own showman, like Roger Corman. You're becoming your own distributor. You're taking things into your own hand, and you're also, what I'm also doing, and this may or may not work with some people, is working with the distribution channels with legitimate distributors like SRS Cinema and Tempe. I think they're still around. These are good places that will work with you to help get the movie out there, and they want to make money off of it, but also not restrict you on, you know, all the other things that you can do. And I think that's the most important thing, is making sure that you keep some of the, you know, your rights and interest to keep propelling and moving ahead with these other avenues, whether it be streaming or a different version of the movie, foreign sales, which used to be really good for these things, but they're much, much, much more difficult. And I don't know what the reasons are behind that, other than, you know, there's so many people maybe making digital movies all over the world now that it's just super competitive, or, again, it's a market that's oversaturated or whatever. Or maybe it's just the internet, because now everybody can just, you know, see it on YouTube.
Right.
My point is, you can put stuff up there and reach an audience worldwide with the internet, and, you know, with a clip and with some excitement and hopefully positive. So, yeah, becoming sort of a one-person distribution, I don't even know what you call it, one-person distribution house, one-person distribution machine.
In-house,
you know, getting the stuff out there and, you know, with whatever resources and money you have, that's pretty much what you've got to do these days. And hopefully it leads somewhere, and it may and it may not. But, again, this is not something that takes – A lot of people are thinking, well, okay, it's not like the major studios where a movie comes out on a Friday and then within the next 2 weeks it's just going to be, you know, a blitzkrieg of publicity and everybody in the world is going to see it. This kind of thing can take many, 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 many years for, unfortunately, for everybody to finally pick up and see it. I mean, I would say the life of a B-movie now is probably at least to get a certain saturation point, especially in the underground scene, is probably 3 to 5 years. And, you know, again, like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, we're talking about movies that we've made here for, you know, 26, 30 years ago, and, you know, we're still talking about them. So here they are, still going and going and going.
Okay, so I'm going to make this a multi-part question, but it's our last one. How about recouping costs? Because it's one thing not to show a profit, which in effect means you did it all for nothing and have nothing to show for all your time and efforts invested here. But it's a whole other ballpark if you owe money to actors, staff, techs, film developing labs, et cetera. How does this typically work? Have you ever been left on the hook? And if so, how do you dig your way out? Because I've heard stories where people put it on their credit cards, max them out, and wind up with a house or car in the line over a movie. And the second part is, assuming that you haven't turned a really good profit on your film, or at least haven't seen a huge financial windfall personally, regardless how well the film may be doing for your distributor. You know, maybe you're in stores all over the country, but the distributor's skimming off the top or underreporting the take, so you have enough to pay everyone off and recoup your investments, but you only walk away with a small amount in pocket. What keeps you moving on to the next film rather than just throwing your hands in the air and moving on to something more lucrative? And what keeps your actors and technicians, be they professionals or friends, coming back for another round?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, and you probably ask 10 different people, and they'll give you 10 different answers. But the thing you have to keep in mind is it's a crapshoot, like anything in life, especially when you're dealing with some artistic endeavor. You've got to be sensible about it. You cannot mortgage your house to make a film. I mean, it's great to have that kind of passion, and I know people do it, but you have to be sensible. You do not want to put yourself in a position where you are ruined financially for the rest of your life, and that can happen if you don't pay attention. A lot of success in the movie industry is being in the right place at the right time, and I know that sounds foolhardy, but it's the truth. If you make $30,000 a year, you don't want to be making a $50,000 movie out of your pocket or borrowing it from a bank or borrowing it from friends. And if you do, you got to be honest. You got to tell them, this may never make a dime. You're taking a risk. Don't promise people something don't tell people something that isn't true, because it's going to come back on you. Like I discussed earlier with Muckman, the movie we made 3 films ago. I'm writing checks today to people who we promised a percentage of the royalties to, and that's what you do. You make good on your bargain, your end of the agreement. That goes a long way. People know you're trying. But again, you've got to be careful. I know people who have sold businesses, quit their jobs, et cetera, because they're going to make a movie and they're going to make $1 million and retire. It doesn't work that way, especially when you come to the second part of your question. What do you do when other people benefit from the movie and you see little or nothing? That's a reality of life. That's a reality of the entertainment industry. I think the higher up the chain you go and the more successful you are, the more you're at risk of getting taken advantage of by people who aren't honest. There are dishonest people in this world. Some of them work in the entertainment industry. You know, that's a sad fact of life. How do you deal with that? How do you keep going? You know, I'd have to answer it this way. If you're in it for the money, you're in it for the wrong reason. If you want to be a doctor, do it because you want to help people, not because you want to make $1 million a year. If you want to be a filmmaker, do it because that's your passion. Success will come eventually, and you cannot determine success based on how much money you make doing something. That's what keeps people like Tim and I going. That's why there's people that started this journey and never finished it.
So what do you think, Tim?
Again, I agree a lot with everything. Yeah, you don't do it for money. You're doing it because you love to do it. It's kind of like, and nowadays with the digital realm, it's very much like artists with paintbrushes. And, you know, how much does paint cost? Not much. So you got to be very sensible about what you spend. I mean, I for Wicked Games, we ended up putting like $5,000 or $6,000 on credit cards, and it took forever for that money to come back. Actually, it never did come back. So I ended up having to pay that off and get two jobs to, and you know, pay that off over a period of like 3 or 4 years because and that's not an extravagant amount, but it is an extravagant amount. So, yeah, the point is don't use your credit card. Don't overexceed what you can afford. I mean, I've made movies for $350 all the way to a couple hundred thousand, and the ones with a couple hundred thousand were not mortgaged houses, and they were not, you know, they were financed by people who knew the risk and they could afford to lose the money if they could, and they were all set up by lawyers and, you know, professional, you know, bankers and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you don't really, chances are, I mean, I know there's success stories with, you know, people that charge stuff and, you know, then they take the movie to Cannes Film Festival and you know, they spent $30,000 on 20 credit cards and then Miramax offers them $1 million for the movie, but the problem with that is that's one success, and there's probably 500,000 people who tried it similarly that year, and they ended up, you know, with their credit card bills and going bankrupt because of the whole situation. So
exactly.
You've got to be smart and definitely be honest with people. I don't offer percentages to actors and actresses anymore. We used to do that, but it got so complex within with the different companies, the different distributors of my own companies changing and if I would move or whatever. So generally what I try to do is just pay them a, you know, a fair amount for doing the job, especially if they're professionals during the, you know, in other words, they get a flat daily rate. If there's, you know, if there is something in the future, I'll put a clause in there that, you know, if the movie does catch on and make, you know, $100 million like Blair Witch or whatever, I mean, it doesn't word it like that, but if it is successful, I would love to share that with everybody who contributed, and they, you know, usually everybody knows that. And like Mark was saying, there is so many people who will rip you off, so definitely you have to put that sort of thing in writing. So, and even if you do put it in writing, it doesn't mean that that particular person is going to adhere to what they say. So you got to be really careful with that, because unfortunately, like in life, there is a lot of people who are dishonest in the movie business and everything. So honesty, integrity, be direct with people, tell them like it is. I mean, those are the best things you can do to build your reputation and the best things you can do for your art, because if you're in the business to become a millionaire or to rip people off, then, you know, that's not good at all. And that's just, you shouldn't even be in the business for that. You should be wanting to create, go through your journey, enjoy the filmmaking process, create and tell a story and have a good time. And that's kind of what keeps us going at this level, I think, is where we just, you know, we don't know how to stop because it is fun. And the whole thing is it should be fun. And it should be a collaborative process that everybody enjoys and everybody's getting something out of, and at least it's something you can put on your resume and then move to the, you know, the next thing. And with each project, I'm never expecting to get rich. I mean, or even if you're lucky if you even break even. That's, you know, the intent is hopefully to make some money off of it, but you've spent an amount that you can afford to lose or an amount that's justifiable to the project that you can see. You know, basically, if you're self-financing it, you want to make just set aside X amount of dollars that you know you're going to lose, like it's a hobby. And then if it does come back over the next 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 years or whatever, then that's fine. But if not, it's just like a lot of people go to sporting events or whatever their passion hobby is, you know, whatever they spend a lot of money on. Maybe they make remote-controlled airplanes or whatever it is. So it really depends on what else you're doing in life to actually, you know, make money. And I think that's something that probably isn't emphasized enough for aspiring movie makers, and it's something that probably I haven't practiced as well as I should have, and that is to have a plan B. You need to have something, some other passion in life in addition to movie making that generates money. For your family, for yourself, and health insurance. You don't get any of that in the entertainment business at all. And it can be a very wicked experience when you have to go out there and scratch for each project and you get ripped off or the check bounces or the money doesn't come through and you're destitute and you're like going, why did this, you know, why did this happen? You got to be really, really, really careful on, you know, not setting yourself up for a big fall while also maintaining, you know, a creative aspiration in life. So I think that sort of answers the question, doesn't it?
Yeah, Tim brings up a good point is that you do have to have, I hope people out there listening or that read about us, I hope they don't think that, oh, these guys are, you know, they're millionaires. They made it because they're still making movies. I mean, I have a day job, and I'm not ashamed to admit that. That's, I have two children. I have a wife. I have responsibilities. I'm a family man. You know, aside from being a filmmaker, we are normal people with normal lives, and I think people forget that. They forget that behind these people are people who have a normal life. You know, we struggle with the same things that most other people do, except we have this added passion or this other piece of our life that's kind of mixed into it. And it's a juggling act. I mean, I don't know, Tim, if you have kids. I have two. They're adults now. I mean, I'm in my mid-40s. You know, life's a little easier than it was, but it's still, you're still juggling a lot. You know, you've got responsibilities to your kids, your family, your full-time job that pays the bills. You know, you own a home. It never ends, but somehow you make this all work. And I think it's important for filmmakers, new filmmakers, to understand that, is that you have to have a fine balance, because passions are great, but so are relationships with people and being a responsible, productive adult, paying your bills on time, et cetera, et cetera. Those things, all that comes into play too. And people, they read about the men and women that make movies, but, you know, they forget that behind them is a life filled with troubles, problems, issues, challenges, joys, triumphs, and tragedies, just like every other person out there.
Wow. I couldn't even think of putting that more eloquently myself. So do either of you very quickly have anything you want to promote at the moment? Because, Tim, I know you have Truth or Dare 4 finally streaming soon. Mark, do you have any upcoming film projects you want to mention?
Well, Muckman, a movie we made 2 years ago, is out through Chemical Burn Entertainment. You can find it and order it from them on the web. Currently, we just finished up a movie called Dark Sleep, based on an H.P. Lovecraft story, Dreams of the Witch House.
Ooh, nice.
We shot Queen Crab, which is going into post-production as we speak. And I just finished a 3D Planet of the Apes-type movie over the summer that I hope to see out on video on demand later this year.
Tim, anything else you want to mention about Truth or Dare 4?
No, just that it's hopefully hitting DVD this December from SRS Cinema, the first incarnation. So look for that.
So with that, Mark, Tim, I'd like to thank you both for joining me here on this little director's roundtable. And you know the door is always open for either of you to come back in relation to whatever you're working on or just to chat on any subject of interest like Tim and I did back in April with the Slasher Show.
Cool.
So,
oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thanks. And it's nice talking to Tim again.
Tim?
Yeah, good talking to both of you. Appreciate everything, man.
So do you want to do one together since we have this unusual circumstance where I have two people on at the same time?
We'll have to write a script and plan it.
Yeah, we got a I got a storyboard of the thing.
I got to find an investor and get insurance.
I don't know. I don't know if we're going to be able to pull this off.
All right. So thanks again, guys. And
thank you.
I'll be talking to both of you soon.
Okay, right, take care.
Everybody take care.
So thanks a lot, guys.
All right, have a good night. Bye.
All right, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed the Indie Film Directors Roundtable. Next time on Third Eye Cinema, Princess of the Night herself meets Sonia Scarlett, eclectic gothic metal innovators, Teatro de Vampire. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker, you're a musician, and would like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network and Blog Talk Radio.
missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our website or Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive, listen, or download at your convenience. And next week.
Okay. Hello, I'm Sonia Scarlett. I'm the singer of Theatre de Vampire, and you are listening to Third Eye Cinema. Thank you, and bloody kisses.
And coming next in July.
Hi, this is James Murphy, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema. Stay classy, New York.